Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Social Work Radio with me, your host, Vince Beard. Once again, we are joined by Cara Davis. Cara, my friend, how the devil are you? How have things been since you were last aboard the good ship SWR?
Oh, I'm doing really well. I'm off, actually. I'm on annual leave, so maybe that's the reason why.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Which is probably, you know, against the premise of joining a social work podcast. But I'm on that relaxed element of heading towards the bank holiday, relaxed, chilled, enjoying quite a few afternoon naps, which probably shows my age.
You were winding me up. So listeners, those of you long-term listeners, kind of, they occasionally see up the wizard's sleeve, and we let on that, you know, we have a bit of a chat before the show with whoever's the co-host that week. And before the show this week, I was just catching up with Cara there, and she says, yeah, you know what it's like using up your annual leave before the year's out? And I'm like, no, Cara, I don't. It has been 9 years since I had annual leave. So a lot of the time people go on about, oh, these agency social workers, these private sector social workers just did it for money. That might be an argument, but there certainly isn't an argument that we get annual leave. So, yeah, thank you for rubbing that in, Cara. It's been a long time indeed. I was in my early 30s when I last had annual leave. So make the most of it, my friend, indeed.
It's the compromise we make, you know. The money, I take the pension and the odd bank holiday off.
Well, make the money. I'm not so sure about the one. That's a fair point, actually. Years ago, I actually did the comparisons because obviously, you know, if you're an agency worker, if you're a locum worker, the hourly rate does look better. But when you factor in sickness leave, when you factor in holiday, in particular, when you factor in pension contributions, there really isn't that much in it. There really isn't. I mean, yes, you get a little bit more now, but you lose out in the long term. And yeah, I can 100% confirm there's no annual leave allowance if you're working privately like I am.
Yeah, like I said last time, I think, is that we should have got into IT or drone flying. Yeah. I feel like that's probably, you know, no money in social work.
No, but plenty of love, plenty of love.
Indeed.
I've had an exciting few days. I'm going to a couple of things to run by. One's like what I've been up to, and the other one's kind of a dilemma. I was in a bit of a pickle yesterday, and something happened to me, and I'm not sure how to take it, so I'm going to share that with you. You ready for this?
Go on, I'm prepared.
So the first update is, long-term listeners will know that my best friend, Jason the Wildcard Williams, was due to have his first boxing match on a kind of underground boxing circuit called Street Beefs. Street Beefs spelled with a Z, B-E-E-F-Z. And I went to his first event on Saturday. There was me and around 25 of the other boys supporting him, and he won, Cara. Not only did he win on his debut, but it was a devastating 45-second demolition. It was superb. Now, he kept his ring music secret. I was like, Jason, give us your ring music before you come in. He says, no, mate, I'm going to keep it secret. I'm not going to tell anyone because I want to hear the crowd pop. Guess what his ring music, his ring walk music that he came into. Guess what it was?
Oh, I've got no idea because all I can think of is do, 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 do.
Rocky. Rocky. It was Like a Prayer by Madonna.
Oh, that's cool.
It was amazing. And he came with his hands up. We're going wild. And yeah, he absolutely wiped the floor. So big things back in the gym working up. Now, bearing in mind, my friend's a bit impulsive. People might say, well, yes, Vince, that's probably why he's friends, because you are somewhat of an impulsive character too. But we get along well, you know, when we're together, there's lots of impulse. We feed off each other. But yeah, he's quite an impulsive guy. He only decided he wanted to get into boxing 6 weeks ago. And yeah, he's won on his debut. So congratulations. I spoke to him after, obviously, we were there. Me and the lads were there. And he says, Vince, you have to give me a shout out on Social Work Radio. So there we go. Congratulations, Wildcard. We will continue to update our listeners. It's a social work / boxing podcast. There's lots of different things.
Absolutely. Oh, wow. That's an amazing achievement, though. I'd be I like the idea of boxing, not me personally, but like I've done a bit of kickboxing in my time, etc. Nice. But the actual thought of someone hitting me in the face, it fills me with fear. So that takes a lot of guts. So yeah, amazing.
Yeah, amazing work. So that was that. Now, the other thing, I'm going to run this past you. you know me, Cara. I try to be a kind and generous guy. I'm generally altruistic in my nature. If somebody needs something, I'll go out of my way to do it. That's just who I am.
Yeah.
And I have been traveling around doing my social work this week. And yesterday I was stopped at some traffic lights in the middle of a big city. And there was a young lady, she must have been in her mid-20s, walking up and down in between the cars with a cup and obviously asking for donations. Not for a charity. She didn't have a lanyard. This wasn't a formal thing, Cara. These were donations mm-hmm. for her own funds. So I put a pound in and said, there you go. Now, I'm a fan of what I call an Aldi tapas. So a lot of the time for lunch, I'm out and about, and I like to eat healthy, I like to eat clean. So quite often, my lunch will just be tapas. And if I'm Aldi, so I'll usually get, you know, some pineapple, some mango, a bit of sliced chicken, a bit of avocado, something like that. You know, healthy, whole, wholesome foods. So I had my goods that I was going to go and find a quiet park to eat them in whilst I was on my lunch break. Mm-hmm. And I'd had the window down, I'd given this lady the pound, and she looked at my car, and she goes, is that melon you've got there? I says, yeah, it is. She says, oh, is that pineapple too? She says, there it is. She says, can I have your pineapple? Mm. So I handed over my pineapple.
Was that hard to let go of?
It was, I'm going to be honest. It was annoying, I'm going to be honest, because like I thought I did a good turn. You know, I'd no one else was giving this lady money. I'd wound the window down. I'd give her a pound. And I was really looking forward to that pineapple. It was kind of tying my day together. You have Friends. Have you seen the Friends episode where Ross is really looking forward to the sandwich, the Thanksgiving sandwich?
The breakdown.
that pineapple, I've got to be honest, it was quite a stressful day. Quite a stressful day. Had a lot going on. Personal life wasn't not issues in my personal life, but a few rumblings in my personal life I was dealing with. And a difficult day at work, and I was kind of missing my kids. And I was like, you know, I was really looking forward to just sitting in the park and eating that pineapple. And that pineapple was taken from me. And it was like I couldn't replace the pineapple because I'd already left Aldi. So I couldn't go back. And I was like, I would have rather she'd asked for an extra couple of pounds than the pineapple, but I gave it to her anyway. Am I wrong to still be... Is it bad of me that I still carry a bit of grievance around that pineapple that I lost?
I'm going to be honest. When you first said that you like an Aldi... tapas. Yeah. I thought that you were talking about the car, and I thought
no, Aldi, the shop. I don't drive an Aldi.
The image of this isn't really giving me altruistic of you in an Aldi car.
No. I get the pineapple.
I mean, I get the emotional attachment to food, especially when you've planned it.
That's what I mean. It was a big thing that
you've decided. I think in the grand scheme of things, you can let the pineapple go, because ultimately, what a nutritious snack that someone else has that you've kind of gifted. So, I think you've just got to breathe and let the pineapple go. It could have been worse. It could have been, you know, their fake Percy Pigs. Was it the Lions? That's my go to Aldi snack. That would have been a bereavement if I had to give up them. But I think you can let the pineapple go.
It wasn't the loss of the pineapple so much. It was just that I didn't have another and I was really looking forward to it. Maybe I could keep like a spare chocolate bar or something instead. Maybe some dried... I don't know. I'm getting too deep into this. This is a social work podcast. Anyway, let's move on. Before we get to this point, it was social work week last week. How did you spend social work week? Were you celebrating it suitably in your part of the world?
Oh, yeah. Woo!
Have some pineapple.
So treated celebrated myself. I shared some posts, and it was nice seeing people, secret social workers. That's always fun when you're like friends with people and then they share like a social work post and you're like, oh, I didn't realize that you were linked to social work in any way. Nice. So that's always quite nice. But no, I'm going to be honest, it kind of passes me by every year. And every year I think, oh, maybe there should be like more celebration. And, you know, occasionally you get the odd message, don't you, on your work emails, kind of celebrating it and taking a moment to reflect on kind of like the fab work that happens day in, day out. But No, there was no cake for me. No popping of champagne at the at my work desk. It was just a regular social work day.
We were quite busy here at Social Work News. We our posts that day reached almost 3 million people.
Wow.
It's really, really good. Yeah, we put out some posts, put out some articles, and I basically in between social work, I was checking on that. It was really lovely to see just how many people shared and commented. And I get the temptation is to be a little bit cynical about World Social Work Day. I kind of get it. I mean, we are social workers, so we have that ingrained cynicism within us. But I don't know. I've become less cynical about it as the years have gone on because it is a day that's just for us. We do celebrate it. Every organization across the world that I'm aware of buys into it. Now, whether we as social workers buy into it or not, but I was on LinkedIn and I saw so many leaders and service leads and directors and managers who were sharing cakes and they had special training days on. Social Work England had lots of CPD. And I kind of think, okay, it might not be what you want of World Social Work Day, but look what we have got. We are lucky to have it. And if you don't, if you're not getting what you want from it, then do something yourself. There's a perfect day to do it. So, as I get older, I'm getting strange. I've got the other way around. Most people are meant to be more cynical as they get older. As I get older, I'm softening in my old age.
I was
going to
say, you become soft. You become soft. I think, I totally agree. And I think we should buy into it more. And I do think that. I think it's a bit, last year we did suicide. I did Suicide Prevention Day, and we don't normally kind of do anything about that. But I went round and I bought some teas and coffees, and basically visited everyone's desk, giving them tea and coffee and Kit Kats.
Nice.
And the joy that it brought was, everyone was like so excited about a cup of tea and a biscuit. And I just think it is those little things. I know we can, like you say, be quite narky about some cake and the emails and the congratulations and the let's take a moment to reflect, but I think, like you say, if you buy into it, if you take a moment and try and remove the social work snark, that actually you can bring little moments of joy.
And did that bring you joy too? Did you feel good doing it?
I felt great. I loved it. We're doing it again this year. Yeah. No,
there
I just
go.
It's such a little thing, isn't it? And I think it's such a little thing sometimes to make people feel good. And I think the odd little celebration, the moment of someone being nice to you, that does feel great. And we should embrace that.
I think one of the most powerful things in work and in life as well is the feeling of being recognized. You know, when you do something good, when you go out of your way, just to be thanked, not to be returned in kind, just to be thanks, we appreciate what you do, a little gesture. I think that can be very, very powerful. We know you're working hard, we know you're doing this, a little gesture. That can make all the difference, particularly in a beleaguered workforce, because we know how difficult and stressful social work is. It can be very difficult indeed. And I'm going to use that and segue into our topic for this week, like a smooth operator, and say, yeah, it can be difficult. Let's have a look at some self-care ideas, but let's actually spin this the other way. Let's, rather than saying what we should do, let's start off by saying what we shouldn't do. On this week's show, listeners, we are going to talk about terrible self-care ideas for social workers. And this comes from a column that Cara wrote for us. As you guys know, having listened to us last week, Cara, as well as being on the podcast, is also a regular columnist over at mysocialworknews.com. Head over there and do check out our articles on there. Last week, Cara wrote one which was titled, "Have You Tried Yoga and Other Terrible Solutions to Social Work Problems?" So, Cara, have you tried yoga?
Often. And you know when you don't want to be doing yoga, when you're really super stressed and you're laying on the floor going, oh my God, I've got so much to do. And they're like, and breathe. And you're like, oh my God.
Amazing.
Just take yourself off onto the cloud. I'm like, I can't be on the cloud. I've got too much to do. But yeah, I think there are lots of ideas like that that float around in social work that are well-meaning, but often don't quite hit the mark. And that's kind of the inspiration of that article, really.
What kind of things have you been asked to do before? Not really asked to do. What would you say the kind of things that have been offered that have been well-meaning but perhaps ill-judged?
I think there's often attempts to kind of fit into workshops of here's a workshop in your lunch break that you can address your work stress. And it's kind of like, well, I can't really leave my desk. I haven't left my desk to have lunch in a long time, you know, in those sorts of times where you're completely overwhelmed. And the idea that you can just go off and do a workshop and manage stress, and that being something that's completely personal to you rather than a responsibility of the organization that you work within, and that kind of individualistic overview of self-care sometimes that can feel very much your responsibility. So those sorts of workshops that look at that, you know, the kind of yoga inspiration type stuff. I sort of mentioned about safety alarms and being given personal alarms when you're kind of forced to go into situations as lone workers, and then sort of, don't worry, you've got this very loud, annoying alarm should anything terrible happen to you. And I think it's those sorts of, they just miss the mark, I think. And that can kind of feed that feeling of loneliness that sometimes social work brings with it.
I think you're right on that one. When you look at those kind of things, when you look at the kind of aspects that you can put in there to try and make a difference, they aren't really done. What you tend to get instead is sticking plasters. What you're saying there, just sort of about the alarm, reminds me of a system that I used to have in place in an old office that I worked in many years ago, which is you had a check-in system. If you're doing a late visit, you would say, well, I'll give you a ring when I get out of the visit. The problem was it would maybe be half an hour after you expected out that people would start sending messages that, you know, are you okay? And by that time, probably a little bit too late if you have been seriously hurt.
Yeah.
It's a hard one to criticize, though, because all of these things that we talk about, like alarm systems, buddy system, check-in systems, even if we go so far as to the offers of mindfulness and yoga, these are well-meaning. You know, these are helpful. You know, nobody's denying that if you apply these practices, they are helpful. It's just in the context of what sometimes feels like an insurmountable wall of work and pressure, these things are not going to make much difference whatsoever. Whereas what would make meaningful difference, lower caseloads, higher staff numbers, buddy systems, more resources, better training at the front door to make sure that cases are filtered out by the time they come through, so there's less pressure and so on, lots and lots of things. Those are hard to do. But that involves more systemic and systematic change. And the problem with that is it's often out of the hands of the people who are set to try and improve things. And a lot of the time, the best that people can do is to offer a lunchtime class. So it's hard because I am loath to criticize when people do things that genuinely have benefit and come from a good place. But ultimately, we have to be honest and say, it's not enough really, is it?
No, and I think you're so on the point. And I think that's probably, when I talked about the social work snark, I think, you know, generally a workforce that are pretty emotionally intelligent, that kind of understand the structural pressures and issues that are happening. And so therefore, something that, you know, potentially someone has worked and put in as a nice gesture and found a resource, you know, it hits a wall that maybe would be accepting in other workplaces, but because of the way that we work, we kind of see it for what it is. And then I think that makes it very difficult for people to embrace it and to engage with it, because that kind of the motivation, I guess, is limited. It's really difficult. I mean, I remember one of the best things that I had at one point was a 10-minute massage, a masseuse that used to come into the council offices, and you know, everyone would come back after 10 minutes smelling a tiger balm. And you know, that probably would look as a, well, we've all got bad backs because we're hunched over our laptops for 8 hours a day, but you know, people embraced it and enjoyed it. So I think it is those that it's really tricky, I think, to understand some of the motivations of what is offered, and then to be accepting of them as well when you, like you say, the big structural issues that you know would make an impact are out of reach.
Yes. I mean, there was a study done several years ago where a free coffee machine was put into a social work office, and that was found to improve mood. Mm. You know, little things like free car parking if your local authority doesn't offer free car parking, having, you know, sessions like you say, pamper sessions and things like that. I think there are small things you can do which can make a slight difference. I'm not going to say they're going to make a massive difference, but they can. It's maybe trying, I would say it's maybe thinking outside the box more, like that massage, you know, sessions you said, like that, the free coffee machine, things like that can make a difference. I think as social workers, we work a lot with clients who are in desperate need of interventions in their life. And when we see what some of our clients get in terms of, you know, very targeted support, in terms of counseling, we can almost be guilty of sometimes comparing ourselves unfavorably and thinking, well, this is what could be done. And God forbid that we then start looking at our friends in the private sector and see if they're what they get in their workplace. Like, wow, I remember speaking to one of my friends many years ago, and he's an actuary. You know, he's on a high six-figure salary, does very well for himself, had of a good guy, Dave. And we were talking about, you know, social work and the support we get. And his mind was boggled. He could not believe the fact that we didn't have some sort of standalone therapeutic supervision or counseling that was outside of perhaps what our HR teams might offer us or what our manager would do on a Tuesday afternoon when they quickly ask for 5 minutes at the end of supervision, how are you doing? I mean, he works in finance. Now, I'm not saying that position isn't stressful, but they have on-site counsellors. They can go and get counselling whether they like. They've got full therapeutic care packages. They've got private healthcare. Now, yes, there's a lot more money in that sector, but he could not believe that the pressures that we're under in social work weren't matched with commensurate means of trying to address that pressure, especially when he was aware of the high turnover rate. Thinking about it from a purely business sense, he thought, well, this doesn't make sense, because if you've got a high turnover rate and you're potentially having to spend lots of money on recruitment and training and retention packages and golden hellos, why don't you simply put more money into retaining social workers through better therapeutic care? Very straightforward when you come in the world of private business, perhaps not so straightforward for the public sector, Cara.
No, it's public money at the end of the day, isn't it? And I think that's sometimes part of the, not the issue, but I guess it's the way in which it's viewed publicly. You know, if there was to be a request for information and actually sort of, oh, you know, £5,000 a year spent on tea and coffee. You know, I think it doesn't look good in comparison to, you know, potentially golden hellos that maybe people would view that in a slightly different way. Or we've got a recruitment issue that's a direct response to that. So I think it is kind of the viewpoint, the way the aspects of it, the way in which the narrative is shared that makes it difficult for sometimes those improvements to be put in place, because it's just kind of viewed in a way. And I remember the tea and coffee thing, such a silly thing, but it's such an important thing. I remember moving, I worked in for a charity in the first day, and they sort of showed me into the kitchen. They were like, here's the toffee, the coffee, the tea, the milk, the biscuits. And I was like, okay, great. So is there like a tea caddy kitty thing? And they looked at me and they were like, no, we just provide you tea and coffee. And I remember thinking, wow. I'm in a different world.
Yeah. We're not in Kansas anymore.
No, I know. And it's kind of that runny joke, isn't it, about the disgusting nature of some public buildings, kitchens, and just working environments in general. So I think that's kind of how we tend to view that. And then that's where people become quite negative about it, because you think, well, we're putting on a workshop for me, but actually what would be really nice is I didn't have to pay out my own money to have a cup of tea. And I think the nature of our work is that we spend all day telling people the ways in which they can live to thrive. You know, this is what you need to, you know, be able to have a stable and thrive in life. And then when that isn't replicated in our own work environments, that can be really challenging and quite difficult to accept, really. And yeah, that just creates that negative framework in which we approach these sort of attempts to look after ourselves.
And I think we can sometimes feel undeserving as well, because when we have a look at the issues our clients can often find themselves in, we sometimes think, oh, I feel a bit awkward complaining about my position because, you know, I'm complaining that we have to buy our own tea and coffee when I've just had to help somebody put gas and electric on to keep themselves warm this winter.
Sure.
Let's have a look at the articles then that, you know, you did your column and then I followed this up with an article, which we'll discuss later, 10 terrible self-care ideas. So in terms of terrible self-care ideas, Cara, let's both be honest here, you know, let's enter the confessions booth. Without getting ourselves in trouble here, let's be very, very mindful. We're not going to offer too much here. So let's be honest here. What self-care, what toxic self-care have we previously indulged in? Would you share a couple of things you've done that were you thought were self-care and were maybe helping you, but actually on reflection were kind of terrible self-care ideas?
Yeah, I think, and we talked about this a little bit in the last podcast, but the sort of toxic alcohol culture within social work, I think is quite obvious. I think, it's kind of a running joke, and probably that's a little bit of British culture, really. Might be different in other social work environments, but, that kind of the Friday night, you know, drinking too much, oh, I'm going to have a wine tonight, I'm just going to finish this report and then I can have a wine. And I think there's that sort of keeping yourself, using alcohol as that sort of stress relief, especially, you know, as we move into the weekends, and the impact that has on you, especially if, you know, you're having a wine on a Wednesday night and then having to get up the next day and functioning on disturbed sleep and just not feeling great. And I think definitely, especially when I first moved into social work, it was kind of, I was quite young as well, like in my 20s, and it became sort of the thing on a Friday night that we'd all go out and that would be like the big stress release of so definitely alcohol was a big part of that. Also the junk table in any social office.
Tell me about it. Feed me, baby, feed me.
That is, you know, and that sort of thing. We talked a little bit about, you know, buying something for someone and being like, oh, I'm such a nice person. You know, coming in with the Krispy Kremes or the donuts, the biscuits, the chocolate, putting it all on the table.
Oh, my God. My tummy's rumbling thinking about those days.
Ah. And, you know, it's 9 a.m. and you've already had like two donuts. And it's kind of like a joke, like a running joke of kind of the food that you're having and you know that sort of, you're not taking a break for lunch, but oh, let's go and get a load of food and kind of really overeat in terms of, oh, I'm just going to get through writing this report and I'm going to overeat to kind of manage that stress, is definitely part of that culture that I definitely embraced.
What's interesting about that phenomena is obviously you and I literally work at opposite ends of the country.
Mm.
And I've shared memes and I've shared stories about that on Social Work World. And we've obviously got, you know, 600,000 followers from across the world. That is a cultural phenomena that happens everywhere. Every social worker listening to this right now will be aware of that. It's not as if it's spread. It's not as if, you know, the International Federation of Social Work have ordered a memo and said, right, yeah, every social worker in the world must have a table. They must have a set-aside table in their office, and that shall be full of cakes, sweets, and chocolates and crisps. Yeah, it happens. It's just, it's such an ingrained part of the social work culture. Literally, there's been a table in every social work team I've worked physically that there was never, it was like an offer, it was almost like an altar. It was like a sacrificial altar to the gods of stress and paperwork that said, any time of the day, you can come and my child, you shall be able to feast on this table of treats. It just happens. Anywhere you go, it just exists. COVID kind of killed it though, didn't it?
It did.
Is it back? I was COVID-ended.
Yeah, it's definitely back. When I've popped into the offices, there's always, where there's social workers, there will be a junk table.
Nice.
And I think, I mean, food is such a social element, isn't it? Especially when you're in the office. And
bonds it's humans.
In a way in which we share, like we care. I mean, I've said I'm a baker. I'm a massive feeder. I love baking for people and seeing people enjoy food. But I think the difference in social work terms is the way in which food is used to manage and cope with the stress. But it's, you know, for, there's always like a week of the year where someone's decided, oh, it's going to be the week, you know, I'm going to put fruit on the table, and the fruit sort of sits there rotting, because ultimately when you're stressed, it's not a bunnet of grapes that you want. It's always junk food. And you think, oh, Sharon's been up to the table five times today. She's having a bad day. It's kind of...
There's a study. There's a study. The correlation between case numbers and trips to the table.
To the table to go. Oh, she's writing a court statement today. She's having a bad day. So, yeah, I think it's just... I think it's not always used in... what it might be in other workplaces or in other times where we enjoy a bit of cake. It's not because we just really enjoy the cake. I wonder how much actually people taste the food that they're eating off those junk tables. It's often just savored. Because we're just really stressed. We haven't had a time to eat proper lunch. You know, we've got a really bad day ahead of us. We're struggling. We've had a bad phone call. Let's soothe those feelings, that anxiety, that stress with something that makes our body feel good for that moment.
And it does make your body feel good. If you have a look at the science behind eating, you know, heavy carbohydrates and heavy sugar and fat content foods, it satiates us. We get a rush of blood to the tummy. We get a rush of blood to the head. It gives us energy. As human beings, we are evolved. We are designed to respond very well indeed to sugary foods and fatty foods and, you know, energy dense foods, because in our hunter-gatherer days, that is what we needed. We had to evolve to search for those foods because that would store energy on for the fallow periods. And look, I've been there myself. If I think about my toxic self-care, it wasn't just eating. It was this, I think the best way I could describe it, Cara, was this desire to treat myself. Or self-soothing might be the best way to describe it, is in order to cope with the difficult times I'm having, I will treat myself. It might be food in the office, it might be a McDonald's for lunch, it might be sneaking in a cheeky McDonald's on the drive home and then having a takeaway for tea. I've done that before. I used to be a fan of the two T's. I wouldn't tell my wife at the time either. I'd be coming home late and there'd be a McDonald's in my tummy, and then I'd get home, oh, do you fancy a takeaway? Yeah, and I'd be, you used to call me 2T Vinny. That used to be my nickname back in the day. 2T Vinny. That wasn't my nickname, but I like the name of it.
You like, the idea of it. But when actually the sad reality of you hiding your McDonald's wrapper.
That's what it was. But it was beyond that. It was like, you know, I treat myself to kind of like computer games. I buy myself some clothes, and on the weekend, like go out for dinner. Just this kind of idea that the root cause of all that and the sort of ethos behind the idea of treat myself was, I've had a difficult time at work. I deserve something. And I was in that mindset. I have to be honest, I was in that mindset for years. I was probably that mindset for the first 6 years of my social work career. I really, maybe 7 years of my social work career. It was already lockdown, really. Yeah, it was probably lockdown that brought me out of that idea. For the first 7 years of my social work career, I was in the idea of, I've had a difficult day, I deserve a treat. And the problem was, is when you are in that cycle, it doesn't end. It just doesn't end, because if your way of dealing with social work stress and pressures is escapism, you never address the root cause of the problem. You just don't. And I was round in that circle. I've got to be honest, Cara, it felt good at the time. I love nothing more than a kebab and a couple of pints on a Tuesday night to treat myself. But yeah, I mean, we'll get on to this next in terms of how I've improved. But before I talk about my changes, what have you learned from what you've done wrong in those potentially toxic self-care routines of the past? What have you changed over time, and what do you do differently now instead?
Yeah, I think for me, it's been about routine and also speaking up for myself. And like you say, that it doesn't feel bad going into the office and having a donut and kind of embracing that toxic culture together. And, you know, you kind of feel, well, everyone does it. We're all like this. but I think it's about, for me, it's about routine. It's about actually being very boundaried with, you know, it's not okay to not have lunch and take yourself away from the desk to do that. And I actually, for me, one of the biggest turning points, I was pretty new in social work, I think, and probably like a couple of years in, and I was in a team that was Well, it was dysfunctional, if I'm honest. It was dysfunctional at the time.
Many of them are, my friend.
You know, and about a third of the team was off sick at any one point, and it was just really chaotic and difficult, and I was pretty green. And I ended up going off sick for sort of 6 weeks with stress.
No, I'm sorry to hear that.
No, and it was a really tough time at the time. And I remember that being that sort of idea of, you know, the last person sat at their desk is the best social worker. But, you know, the person that never leaves their desk to go for lunch is the best social worker. Mm-hmm. I'm working the hardest because I'm still here at 9 p.m. and you lot all went home at 5. Yeah. And actually that reality check of, that doesn't make me any better, but that doesn't make me a good social worker. That doesn't make the quality of the work that I do any better. And actually having a good bedtime routine, getting up in the morning, going for a walk, taking myself away at lunch break, you know, eating and having a routine to eating actually makes me a better social worker. That makes me, you know, and also it means that I'm not away for 6 weeks. I'm not sick every other month because I'm too stressed or I can't get myself out of bed. That's what makes you a good social worker. And I think it's when you realize that really changes your approach to self-care.
Do you mind me asking if you hit a kind of certain point when that all dawned? Was there a kind of low point or a eureka moment, or was it just a gradual realization?
I mean, I can laugh about it now, but because it's been many a year since that happened. But I got to a point where I kept on walking to my desk, and every time I got about two desks away from my desk, I just burst into tears.
Oh, God.
And I just, it was like just absolute overwhelm. I mean, at the time, I hadn't had supervision for 6 months. I was, you know, I was still really new, like, didn't really, you know, and I'd kind of had a high caseload of young people that I really, really cared about and just like really cared. And I felt, you know, sort of 26 or 27 years old, felt like I was mum to like 30 babies, and I wanted to like be the best, you know, person to them, and just felt completely overwhelmed by the task. And yeah, I kept on walking into the office and bursting into tears. And I just thought I literally couldn't do the tasks that were set in front of me because I was just so overwhelmed and upset. And it took about three weeks of being off sick before I stopped waking up in the middle of the night thinking about one of my young people and thinking about what I had or hadn't done, you know, my to-do list. It took a long time to change my brain. And that was really the point of thinking, I got into the office and I just thought, I don't want to do social work anymore. This isn't what I thought it was. And I couldn't do what I thought was being a good social worker. And so that essentially left me to the point of going off sick, and it was coming back, and I had a different manager when I returned, and it just completely shifted the way in which I approached the role and the job and creating those boundaries, because I just couldn't function if I wanted to carry on being a social worker in that same way.
How do you feel looking back at that time now?
I feel really sad that that happened, and that happened to so many people in that team at the time. But I also feel it was like really monumental in making me the kind of practitioner that I am now. Like I think I'm a better social worker because of that experience now, but I wish at the time I'd had someone come alongside me and actually stop me from doing that in the first place. You know, actually it doesn't have to be like that. And I think that's something as a manager I'm really trying and embed in terms of those that I work with, is actually, you know, that isn't okay. You know, if I see someone sending me an email at 9 p.m, I'm like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? Don't do that. You don't need to do that. And this is the reasons why you don't need to do that. Not because, you know, I don't think that what you're doing is important. Not that I don't want to hear what you're saying about this situation or what your worries are, but actually this is the time where you should be with your own family, or this is the time that you should be doing that. And actually it's important for your brain to be able to switch between work life and home life, and that you can't function at that level and continue in your career because you will burn out. And I've seen so many people just leave social work, and actually you can't be a good social worker if you're not a social worker anymore.
Oh, powerful story, my friend. I genuinely, I really, really do appreciate you sharing that. Thanks ever so much. I think I would say I've gone through a similar journey to you. You've known me for a long time, Carrie. You've known me in person. You know, we first met about 6 years ago, and we sort of were speaking to each other before that online a fair bit. And, you know, I'm incredibly driven, you know, I've got ambitions and I want to do and I want to achieve and I always have ideas. And I got into social work and I always wanted to complete it. Right, I wanted to be top of the class. That was always what I wanted to be throughout my entire childhood. I wanted to be the best. I wanted to be top of the class. I wanted to be the funniest. I wanted to be the loudest. I wanted to be the center of attention. Surprise, surprise, here I am hosting a social work podcast and one of the most prominent figures in the social work world. Who would have thought it? It doesn't take a psychologist or a counselor to work out that one. But lo and behold, I've always been that way. And I found it very, very difficult in social work because no matter how hard I worked and how much of myself I gave, my only reward was more work. That was it. I've closed this case, have another one. You're doing really well. You're coping here, Vince, aren't you? Yes, have more. I've told this story many times. I tell it time and time again because I think it's a very important lesson for our listeners to hear. At the end of my very first year as a social worker, which was over 10 years ago now, I ended up with 45 cases, over twice what people should have, simply because I wouldn't say no, because I thought saying no was an admission of guilt. I ended up leaving that job. I touchwood saved myself before burning out because I found another position that had a lower caseload. But it was the same pattern again, have to be the best, have to do the most, have to prove myself, always this constant drive to prove myself. And in a profession like social work, that doesn't really work because just as you were saying earlier there about, well, you prove that by being the last one in the office, you prove that by answering emails. The only way to prove that, because it's very, very difficult to measure the intangible outcomes of how good you are with a client, you can just measure the KPIs, the quicker assessments, the visits on time, that's how you do it. And that involves more and more work, particularly if you've got more and more cases. And like I was saying earlier, that ended up in a position where I wasn't eating well, I wasn't sleeping well, I was drinking more alcohol than I should, and I wasn't living my life in accordance with nature. I was living an unnatural life. I wasn't listening to my body. It was almost like I'd made an enemy of my own body, to be perfectly honest. I disassociated my actions from my body when I had pains in my chest because of my hernia that was playing up, because of my diet. I discounted it when I wasn't sleeping properly. I discounted it when I was looking older than I should have. I discounted it when I was putting on weight. I discounted it. I almost disassociated my physical body from my mental body, and that was kind of the way that I kept things going. And it kind of all came to a head, really. And I was going down a very difficult route indeed, because I just wasn't switching off. And I found myself, getting increasingly bothered by things that shouldn't bother me, As you know, Cara, we occasionally get the odd troll that bothers us here. And I've had a certain couple of people in social work that have bizarrely stalked me for years and years and years. I'm not going to mention the names here, but Cara, you know who these people are. They've stalked and harassed me and traumatized me, do things like track my children down, impersonated me, contacted employees, done all sorts of bizarre things for no real reason whatsoever. I've never, bothered these people in person. They just, sometimes don't like people with a big platform, such is the way of the internet. I'm not the first and I'm certainly not the last. You've been targeted. You know what it's like yourself, Cara, too. And those things were really, really getting to me. It was all getting too much. And it's going to sound awful to say this because, of course, I would never have wished a global pandemic, but lockdown kind of came at the right time for me because it gave me a big reset. It allowed me to think, well, actually, Vince, who would you want to be? Where do you want to be? And that ability to work from home allowed me the time and space and opportunity to kind of just focus on, well, what are my needs in the workplace? I'm working from home. Okay, how can I work best? So I looked at lots of efficiency techniques. I looked at my diet. I looked at exercise. I looked at meditation. And from that point onwards for the past 4 years, it's been a kind of constant improvement, really, to the point where, you know, I don't say this to be sanctimonious, but I don't drink any alcohol. I don't smoke. I'm not on any medication anymore. I used to take medication for my stomach. That's improved. I don't experience anxiety anymore. I'm sleeping really well. My personal life's in order. I have a better relationship with my children than ever before. Even though I'm in the process of divorcing my wife, I've got a better relationship with her than I've ever had before. I'm closer to my friends. I'm closer to my family. You know, I don't eat any processed food. I don't eat sugar or wheat or dairy. I've just made all of these changes. And it all simply came back to that point of giving myself a little bit of time to breathe, sitting down and having the opportunity with lockdown coming about to think, who am I and what do I really want? Am I on the right course for me? Or am I halfway up a ladder I don't want to climb, or more likely halfway down a hole I don't want to fall down? Yeah. And that gave me a bit of reset. Now, I'm not saying listeners, you should wish for another lockdown. I think you could do that by taking a couple of weeks out of work. I think you could do that by, if you could, taking a short sabbatical if you've got the money, or even just, you know, locking yourself away for a weekend. I think there is many ways to do that. But for me, it was that dawning realization of, okay, who am I? What do I want? And listening to what my body was telling me. And from that point onwards, you know, look, there's occasional slippages. Got to be honest, sometimes when I'm stressful, I like nothing more than eating a whole tub of vegan ice cream. I sometimes like gorging on vegan, vegan millionaire shortbreads at difficult times. But that used to be the norm. Now those things might happen once every couple of months.
Yeah. You're so true. That reset in COVID was such an important dawning realization that you could do things differently. You didn't have to do things the same ways that you've always done them. And I think, like you say, that reset and that commitment, and maybe that's exactly what my time away from work, having been on sick, did. It was actually that sort of like, oh, you know, and I'm not suggesting that everyone in social work goes off sick for a few weeks, because we'll be in dire straits.
But I've lots of complaints from employers in as well.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not signing your sick notes.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it is that, you know, like you say, having that moment and being like, what life do I want to live? Because the hypocrisy of living in chaos and then trying to support other people in changing and developing their own lives is mad, really.
Yeah.
And you know, spending all day talking about positive ways in which to live your life and to act towards goals and tasks when we're not doing that ourselves is just ludicrous.
Yeah. What are your current self-care routines, then, if you could offer some sort of tips to our listeners, or perhaps to your younger social work self? What's working for you right now?
So for me, it's a level of honesty. I think you have to be honest about your workload, what you're struggling with, utilizing supervision. I know that's such a eye roll moment, but actually, you know, I think one of the things I've always done is demand to have supervision. Actually, I need this time to be honest with you about what I am or are struggling with. I always try and take a lunch break of some sorts.
Yes.
And I always try and get outside every day, and some days that's hard because the weather and it's miserable, and sometimes you just want to curl up and into a ball, especially working from home. But being outside is so important. I sea swim quite a bit now, which, you know, is such an important thing for me in terms of connecting myself with something that's bigger.
Grounds you to nature, my friend.
I love sea swimming and being outside and going for a walk by the sea and just being connected to something, because when you're staring at your laptop for hours and hours on end, you're pulled into this world, and actually taking a break from that is really important. So that's, for me, that routine, like I said, you know, sleeping, finding that importance of getting up at a certain time every day, not rolling out of bed, especially that working from home element of, rolled in out of bed and it's 8:45 and here I am.
It can be glamorized, that, can't it? I think that can be glamorized and almost, you know, that, look, we're not going to have a go at people for doing that, but equally that isn't something we should hold up as a good way of living and a good way of working.
No, I mean, it makes me feel terrible. And, you know, there are days where, you know, sitting on your sofa with your laptop is the way of getting through that day. You know, you might not feel great, you know, lots of things are happening, et cetera, et cetera. But I think there's a reason why some of these structures and, you know, the importance of having a desk and the importance of having a workspace and a home space and the importance of, you know, sleep and like you say, listening to your body and whatever that is, you know, some days that is going to be, hey, today I just really need to have a nourishing dinner and cook for myself and not just get whatever's out of, you know, the microwave. And some days it might just be a quick meal that is what you need, but it is about listening to yourself and not being so dissociated with that, because the level of stress and anxiety you're dealing with is overwhelming that ability and overruling that sense of who you are.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And what you've said there is very, very similar to what I'm going to say here. For me, it all comes down to routine. And the basis of all the improvements in my life have simply been keeping the promises that I set to myself. I used to be a great one for every Sunday night thinking, right, my life's going to be different tomorrow. Tomorrow morning's going to be different, or next month's going to be different, or, well, I'll get to my birthday. By the time I'm 30, by the time I'm 40, I was always pushing off my improvements and ambition to a future date. And then I realized life is what happens right now. It isn't the mistakes in the past. It isn't what you're going to do in future. It isn't the worries or even your hopes and ambitions for the future. Life happens at the cutting edge here and now. And it was realizing that I have to be my own future friend. I have to be disciplined. I have to say what I'm going to do, I'll say. I have to say what I'll say, I'll do, should I say. I have to love the process, not just the goal. I have to recognize my urges. I have to know that I have power over my mind. But ultimately, it came down to keeping the promises that I made to myself. And those promises generally are getting up early, owning the morning. I love to go for a walk first thing. If I can see the sunrise and get some sun in my eyes first thing in the morning, it's a wonderful start to the day. Come home, do some meditation, do my morning journal, set my daily tasks. Work hard during the day. I certainly work hard. Between 9 till 5, Cara, I work very hard indeed. Well, actually, I start earlier, but I usually work for Social Work News, you know, first thing in the morning, get my articles there, 7 till 9. But yeah, for 8, 9, 10 hours a day, Monday to Friday, I work very hard indeed. But aside from when we do the podcast around the evening, when it comes to 5 o'clock, I stop work. I'll occasionally reply to an email on my phone, but I don't intentionally work. And if I'm traveling back, I'll do that. But I work hard, but I work in disciplined periods. And it's literally just keeping the promises that I make myself. It's recognizing what I need, promising what I'm going to do, and sticking to them. Now, there's lots of techniques that fall within that, such as meditation, healthy eating, mindful eating, journaling, doing my morning mantra, doing visualizations, and so on. But I used to dismiss all self-help. I used to think, oh, it's all gobbledygook. People are telling the truth, to be honest, Cara. You do feel better if you exercise,
it's
meditation.
It's so annoying.
It's annoying, isn't it? It's so annoying when you realize a walk makes
you feel better. You're like, I'm on this mental health walk for my stupid mental health. And it turns out it does make you feel better. Very annoying.
I know. It's like all the stuff you dismiss and think, that's not meant for me. It is meant for you. So it really is sticking to those boring, tried and tested self-care routines, not pushing myself hard. But look, I have the occasional difficult days, and I'm going to be honest, sometimes I have to work evenings, sometimes I have to work weekends, but it's not the norm, it's not the expectation. When I do that, I'm doing it through choice. I'm doing it through choice. And I usually say, well, actually, do you know what? I might have to work a weekend, but I'm going to do it early. I know that I might have to do a little bit of extra work. This weekend, I haven't got anything on. I'm not seeing my kids. I'm going to do the work now, rather than leaving it to the last minute and hoping it won't go. Hoping it'll go away and won't happen. So yeah, it's just very, very boring advice from both of us, which is eat healthy, try and get a little bit of exercise in, be mindful, do your meditation, go for walks, and literally do all of the things that you see in those motivational Instagram reels.
Just do it.
Just do it. Yeah, like a night, Edna Nike advert. Edna Nike advert. Well, we were meant to be talking about terrible self-care ideas, but we haven't really had time to do that. But listeners, if you actually want to get something that's linked to the actual article, the headline of this podcast, head over to mysocialworknews.com. You can see an article that I wrote last weekend about 10 terrible self ideas for social workers and what to try instead. Spoiler alert, it's 10 ideas about the kind of things that me and Cara said we used to do, and 10 alternatives about the kind of things we are doing now instead. As always, listeners, it has been a delight for you to tune in. Thank you ever so much. You can head over to mysocialworknews.com. Check out Cara. I was going to call you Cara there. Cara. Check out Cara. We're going to be talking about self-care. Check out Cara the Carers. There we go. Check out Cara the Carer and Vinny 2T's articles. Cara's are out every Friday. My columns are out every Thursday. Obviously, you can check out the other articles we've discussed. And there is a plethora of other content as well over at mysocialworknews.com. Please do consider leaving a review for this show if you've liked it, and we will read it out next week. Until next week, when we'll be back with Who Knows What, it's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me.